Okay, well, as is my normal wont, this is the cast of characters who have contributed to what I'm going to talk about today. In blue is Evan Levine, who is the graduate student who's just graduated, who's done most of the work. And Evan, I should point out, is now working in the State Department in Washington and as a liaison with the Department of Homeland Security, and I'm sure that all of the things that he learned as a graduate student are going to serve him very usefully there. Okay, the story begins with the best new survey of atomic hydrogen that exists. This survey has been done with two terrible old telescopes, one of them that's at least 50 years old and another one that's probably 35 years old. They were outfitted with new receivers, but it was not an issue of the sensitivity that made this survey important. This was done with the Leiden telescope at Twingelo, the 25-meter, an almost identical telescope at Villa Elisa in Argentina. And the key was Peter Kalberla in Bonn, who what he had done was to work out and measure the diffraction pattern of the telescopes. And this is the side lobe response from the Dvingelo telescope, and was able to remove these from the spectra. And the idea here is that if you take a look at this random position in the sky, you see this one spectrum. The spectrum taken some months later, I guess almost 6 months later, of exactly the same position in the sky shows this spectrum. And the problem is that you have this bright Milky Way which crosses the side lobes, fills up a lot of the space, so that even though the side lobes are down in power, produce a great deal of the of spurious emission from the spectrum. And although you can't see it in this plot, this was the best one I was able to find, that the spectra, once you take out the side lobe response, allows you to generally know that your emission is good to close to about 1 part in 10 to the 3rd, which is the black is the emission that has been removed that is from the side lobes themselves. That's how much is removed from the spectrum. In these cases, it's how much is responsible for the emission in each of the spectra. Okay, so given this spectrum, given this survey, I thought a few years ago that there was a good reason for doing a new analysis of the atomic gas in the Milky Way, and this comes down to the substructure problem. Now, if you take a look at the Via Lactea simulation, and what one finds is that we have 1,000 subhalos with masses of greater than 10 to the 7th solar masses, one can ask, how frequently should one be passing through the atomic hydrogen disk of the Milky Way? And the answer is there should be about one at any one time, of order of one. Now, that's plus or minus probably an order of magnitude, but it's better than 100 or 1/100th, because the atomic hydrogen layer is the coldest layer and will be most responsive if we have one of these things going through the layer. So the question is, can we detect the subhalos by seeing their interaction with the atomic gas? Well, as it turns out, that to be able to do this problem is you have to learn about the atomic gas to begin with. So we began to reanalyze the atomic gas layer. Now, to give you some idea of where to start is an all-sky survey, not all-sky, the all-galactic plane survey was done almost 20 years ago by Henderson, Jackson, and Kerr, more than 20 years ago. Sorry about that. But one of the things that we notice, and all of the surveys of atomic hydrogen have used this north and south survey, but you notice that there's something wrong here, is that if this is a map of this H1 surface density, and if one tries to connect contours across the galactic anticenter and in the direction of the galactic center, one finds a discontinuity in the surface density as one goes across that line. Now, if one observes the atomic hydrogen maps of other galaxies, we don't see discontinuities like that. So one would like to find a simple prescription to see how one might be able to get rid of this discontinuity. And the one that we found was to add a component of velocity to the gas motions. And this allows one to match up the hydrogen surface densities across this, both of these positions. So this is the equivalent of an m equals 1 epicycle to the orbits of the atomic gas. And when one applies that to the gas, one finds that we get a very nice match across the galactic center and galactic anticenter. Now, and this now will allow us to be able to make modal analyses of the atomic gas and to learn something about the atomic gas in a way that really hasn't been able to be done quantitatively before. Now, the gaps in the data occur because you do this analysis kinematically. You assign a distance to a particular velocity because of the rotation curve, and here all the motions are going essentially transverse to the line of sight, so you have no information. Sorry? This assumes a smooth rotation curve. This, no, that's an independent assumption. It's not an assumption that you use a measurement. It's an m equals 1 epicycle to the gas motion, but I'm going to come back to that. Let me come back to that because that's an important. Let me come back to that. Yes, David Spergel and I did something like this almost 20 years ago, but we added a single velocity component, not one that was dependent on distance from the galactic center. And not necessarily. The thing is, we don't actually know. And this becomes part of the story. So if you can hold questions like this until I get to some of the conclusions, then yes, thank you. Now, let me just make one point here. Let me make two points here. One is that the disk of stars ends at about this location where I'm showing you now. And nevertheless, we see considerable structure here in the contours, and that's due to the velocity dispersion of the gas. Now, when we look at other galaxies, we see typically the H1 extends far beyond the radius of the stars. Nevertheless, the velocity dispersion of the gas remains constant or nearly constant, even though we don't have any sources of excitation for the energization of the gas. We don't have supernovae, we don't have OB associations. Nevertheless, the velocity dispersion remains just about constant, and we don't know why. There is. I've actually taken out a little thing that here it says there's a residual m equals 2 component here as well, but we haven't analyzed the m equals 2 component. This goes back to stuff that we talked about some years back, but let me go on. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention is that this is now probably the best map of surface density map of atomic hydrogen that we have in the Milky Way. And one of the reasons for building the Dvingalo telescope in the first place was that Oort thought that this was a great way to find spiral arms in the atomic gas. And can you all see the spiral arms in this picture? No? I hear it chuckling. Well, you can't. But let me come back before I go on and see if there's something we can do to tease out some of the spiral structure. Say that I believe this component, this is not an ad hoc thing that we're adding to the gas motions. This is due to the true gas motions of the gas. But what are these things due to? Why does one get, now this comes down to the physical reason, where we may get this epicycle. One is that it's possible if we have radial gas inflow in the galaxy. In other words, everything, this analysis assumes circular rotation, but if we have in addition a radial gas inflow with velocities equal to that, that'll provide this epicyclic motion to the gas. The other possibility is that there's that this is being driven by a halo where there's an M equals 1 distortion. It could be an M equals 1 distortion in the potential of the dark matter halo itself, or it could be that everything is symmetrical, that the halo itself is symmetrical, but the orbits of the gas are not centered in the same place that the orbits of the potential of the symmetric dark matter halo. Both of those will give you an M equals 1 distortion. And you can't tell from the data that we have which of these things is responsible. We did. And I think that analysis is wrong. Give me a chance, Andy. Okay, so if we take a look at this symmetrization, that I like to call it, of the gas in the Milky Way, this is what you get if you just look at the surface densities and apply circular rotation model. If you add this V pi component, you get a very nice, reasonably good agreement between the surface densities on both sides of the galactic center. Okay. Sorry? Can we? Oh, I think we are. Question is, how lopsided are we allowed? And I don't know. I can only tell you how lopsided I think we are. All right, well, this is the same map of the H1 surface density contoured in a slightly different way. And we can see some hints of the spiral arms. I think this shows it up a little bit better. But if we take a look at this and we ask at this map, do we live in a spiral galaxy? One would be hard-pressed to say that this looks very much different from a bug that gets splattered on my windshield when I'm driving up I-5 in the evening. Ah, but the spiral arms should be beyond here as well. But wait. I'm a radio astronomer. And the thing is that for years I thought I had nothing to learn from the optical community. Until I looked at this plot and I said, there's something that the radio astronomers have never done, and I've never understood why. And that is, they've never done an unsharp masking of this image. And if you take this image and you do an unsharp masking, this is what you get. And what we're looking at is a map of the surface density perturbations to the H1. And we see beautiful spiral arms coming out. Now, are they symmetric spiral arms? No. And the question is, how does one put these things together? Well, I would think that you put these things together. It's not entirely clear how you pull things together across the center and anti-center. And the orange is excess surface density. The gray is below average surface density. Counter-rotating. This is the map. You can interpret it any way that you like. Yeah, Hans.
In external galaxies, you see beautiful, large holes to remind what the region is for them.
I think you would not see the holes. I think the holes may be things like this. These features in here, and it has to do with the fact that we're using velocity and velocity perturbations. The holes themselves, when they're caused by explosions, and I hope Martin will have some time to talk about evidence that many of them are not, then the holes are cause velocity perturbations, which then show up as distance perturbations here. Yeah, Heidi. Okay. Now this is one way of putting it together, and I emphasize that it's one way of connecting the spiral arms. One of the things to keep in mind is that the relative perturbation of these arms, not the actual surface density, but remember this is relative to the average surface density at a particular distance, is relatively constant. The other thing that I found very puzzling about this picture is that, again, the stellar disk ends about here, yet we're seeing spiral features well beyond where we expect the stellar disk. At this distance, this is about 2 R0 here. This is a little more than 2 R0, the size of this circle. At 2 R0, what we're seeing is if the scale length is about 3 kiloparsecs, we expect the surface density of stars to be about 2 solar masses per square parsec. Once we get out to here, it should be, you know, we're talking about nearly 10 scale lengths from the center, and there should be essentially no stars there at all. Nevertheless, what? Monoceros ring would be about here. This is the direction of Monoceros anyway, so. Okay, here's the classical spiral arm pattern. It doesn't look like it fits very well. The pitch angle, if you try to, these are logarithmic spirals. These logarithmic spirals have pitch angles of between 21 and 25 degrees, so that they're much more open than what one gets from classical spiral arm pictures. Now, there's one other thing that I found interesting about this. One of the things you can do is you can also make a scale height map, a thickness map of the galaxy. And you can ask, what if I make a thickness map of the galaxy? Do I see the spiral arms? And it turns out, yes! Amazingly, you can see the spiral arms in the thickness. And the question I ask to the dynamicists in the audience is, should the thickness of the arms be thicker or thinner in the place where you have excess H1 surface density? Now, the excess density is shown in this, in the orange. And in the next, I'll show you the unsharp mask map of the 21 of the thickness. And you see they reverse color. In fact, what you find is that the spiral arms, the H1 in the spiral arms, is thinner than in the interarm gas. So gravity wins. Okay, if you can do it without. And the last time you challenged me to something like this, Martin, we published a paper together, so. Okay. So let's go on, and then there's a question of, this is all of the cataloged CO clouds are in the blue, and they fall almost entirely on these H1 excesses, but there are a few that you can see that are lying in between. But there's a very good correlation between the H1 and the CO clouds, and them to be. Okay, so now the next thing we can do is ask, where is the position of the midplane? So the things that we do is we look at the surface density, the deviation of the midplane from B equals zero, and we look at the thickness. So again, here this is a map of the warp that was done by Henderson, Jackson, and Kerr. Here is the warp going up, the warp goes down, but it comes back up again in something that I talked about in 1982 in a separate paper, is scalloping at the edge of the galaxy. Now, part of the problem here is that the warp has rarely been quantitatively analyzed, largely because this thing has been hard to describe. And the best description actually came in Binney and Merrifield, where they gave a rough description of what the position of the warp was. But what we can do is, now that we've symmetrized this, is do a Fourier analysis and ask what are the modes, what are the important global modes in this. Now this is the map, this is just the map. Again, gray means that it's below B equals zero. Here is the red and blue is above B equals zero, and you can see, as has been known for probably about 40 years, the wharf is much greater in what I talk about as the northern part. I talk about this as the northern part of the Milky Way. This is the southern part, because we see this most easily from the northern hemisphere telescopes, and this from southern hemisphere. So if we ask now, let's do a Fourier analysis, and what are the modes that we see in this? Before we get to that, this is just a plot at an oblique angle of what we would see. This is a 5x exaggeration. You have to be able to imagine that you can see a dip here in this gray part of the emission. L of 90 is in this direction. This is 180, this is the galactic center, and this is 270. Okay, well, these are the global modes that you see, and that is that you see a lot of power in the m equals 0, m equals 1, and m equals 2 mode. And then after that, it's more than an order of magnitude down. So we can say, essentially, that almost all the power is in three modes in the galaxy. And we can ask, what do these three modes look like? Just to remind you, an m equals 0 looks like a bowl. An m equals 1 looks like an integral sign. You don't see it so well in this oblique. M equals 2 looks like a saddle, and you add them all together, and you get something like this. Now, for a press release one time, if someone asked if this were a drum, what note would it be striking? Well, it turns out it's 64 octaves below middle C. And basically what this says is 2 to the 64th is a very large number. The first time I showed this, this is what I was referring to, Martin, I thought, if you get an M equals 0 mode, how do you get that without having some interstellar intergalactic medium push all this atomic hydrogen in one direction? And Martin said that I know I can do it another way. And I probably lost a bet to him. Let me see. That slide is further on. But let me show you quantitatively how these modes go with galactic radius. The M equals 1 is the dominant mode at all radii. This is radius, and this is the amplitude of the mode. M equals 0 and M equals 2 have almost the same amplitude. They don't begin to about M equals 15. This is probably at roughly 2 R naught at the edge of the stellar disk. And then they become separated a bit beyond about 25 kiloparsecs. So we have a quantitative explanation of the modes, a quantitative description of the modes, which can be used to actually do dynamics and try to be able to determine how one might be able to get this sort of ringing in the galactic disk. Now, if you take a model of just these three modes, you put them together, compare them to the observations, and they look pretty good. There's clearly some high frequency components. Most of these high frequency components are due to the velocity dispersion of the gas. Scott, you were asking about the phases of the modes. I don't have an answer in the way you phrased the question, but this is the line for the M equals 1 bending mode. Well, this is where you were asking before about the mode in the plane, but this is a bending mode. This is the line of steepest ascent for the M equals 1 mode, and this is for the M equals 2 mode.
I was really asking about the M equals 1. Yes,
and I don't know. I have to think about that. I don't have the answer at the top of my head. Okay, so the thing is that if these modes occur, these same sort of modes occur in other galaxies, one of the things we know is that we have asymmetric warps in other galaxies. And it may be that the modes themselves may not be truly asymmetric, and that you have something going on that's different on one side of the galaxy than the other, but it may be just because you have a superposition of odd and even modes, and they give you different appearances and different apparent asymmetries on each side of the galaxy. Okay, and here's just another way that we compare the data to the model. And this is when you ask, well, what gives rise to these modes? I'll leave that to Martin to talk about during his talk. Okay, now what I've said is that we have analyzed the surface density, the deviation from the midplane. Now we can ask, what is the thickness relative to the midplane? And how does that go? Well, this is a map of the thickness of the gas. And it looks relatively unremarkable, except that it seems to be a little bit thicker here. But if you average all the northern gas and the southern gas together, one gets a surprising result. So if we first take a look at the surface density, we see that inside of 10 kiloparsecs, from 10 to about 13, we get roughly constant surface density. And this continues at this value close to all the way in towards near the center of the galaxy. The surface density falls off. Now, quantitatively, these thickness plots are not so different from what's been found from other analyses of the Milky Way. However, you have this this is from the northern part, the thickness of the northern part. This is from the thickness of the southern part. And this is the average thickness together. And this is what's been done before. But if you take a look at this and you say, wait a minute, something's not right here. How can the thickness on one side of the sun center line be a factor of 2 larger than the thickness on the other side of the sun center line? What can be giving rise to this? This is not a local effect. We've done all sorts of things, take out what we think are bad areas in the data, take various slices of the data. You always get this result. The actual values may change a little bit depending on what data you remove from the system, but it turns out that the northern gas is thicker by a factor of 2 than the gas in the south. What can give rise to this? Well, one of the things that can give rise to this is...
Do you think those numbers are arbitrary, or is that the point of maximum deviation?
You mean that it was 0 to 180? Yeah. No, it's because the line of nodes passes very close to the sun center line. So what I should have said is that those lines of maximum descent, maximum ascent in the warp that I was showing, the sun center line, the line of nodes is perpendicular to that line. Notice one of the things I didn't say is that there didn't seem to be any precession in those lines of maximum ascent, or effectively in the line of nodes. So one of the things that we've done is to see, can we get the north and the south deviations, or the thickness from the midplane, by assuming that you have an n=1 distortion in the potential of the halo. And the answer is we do a very good job. However, the rotation curve, it requires some input rotation curve model, and the input rotation curve model is falling, whereas the one we've used to analyze the H1 itself is relatively flat. So I think this tells us, what this tells us basically is that you can do this, but you need a more sophisticated model than we've been putting in so far. Now, at the same time, by using the m=1 to the warping of the galaxy and the m=1 in the plane of the galaxy, that is this several to 15 kilometer per second apparent inflow or velocity that we get from another the same m=1 distortion, can you build a model that combines all of these things to give you all of these asymmetries in the H1? The answer is, I don't know. That's work that's still to be done, but I think it can be done, and it's probably not all that hard to do. Okay, and as I mentioned before, that this M equals 1 bending distortion can be due to an asymmetry in the potential or an off-centeredness of the disk. Now, let's get back, before I end, I wanted to get back to the original motivation for doing this work to begin with. Remember, the idea was, can we find any evidence that there's stuff going through the H1 halo? And so if we subtract the three lowest order global modes from the data, and then do another Fourier analysis and ask, what modes do we see in this that remain with any power whatsoever? We're looking for the low, low order modes, for the high order modes. It's not, well, it's not exactly the same Fourier analysis, but the thing is that what we're taking out is the smooth distributions from the data to see if there are higher order modes that are there over and above the noise. Yes.
If you take out the first three normal modes, it should have zero for the first three. No.
Yes, this I don't know the answer to that question. But in any event, we can ask these modes that are left are around M equals 5, 10, and 15. And one can ask, where are they in the disk? And it turns out that these are localized modes. These things occur only on part of the disk, not over the whole disk, not global modes. Was that 1 minute left? Okay, let me rush through this then. And what I think we're seeing are localized perturbations of high azimuthal wave number. Another way to see these sorts of things is to just simply subtract the map, the actual data from the smooth data from the M equals 1, 2, and 3 modes. And we do see these perturbations in the disk. They're too large to be seen to be due to supernovae. They're too far out in the disk. Could they be due to ringing of the disk due to dwarfs passing through the disk? Maybe. Could it be due to some of these ghost tidal streams passing through the disk? Maybe. Could it be evidence for mini halos passing through the disk? Maybe. But one of the things we'd like to do is to say, can we look at other galaxies and see evidence of the same thing? And this is from a paper by Petrick and Rubin that was published, Rupin that was published last year, of the galaxy that has the smallest H1 line width that's known. That is, it's very face-on, very, very quiescent galaxy. And this is a plot of the surface density of the 21 centimeter, and this is a plot of the line width of the 21 centimeter. And it's very close to being constant. This goes out to 20 kiloparsecs from the center. And the H1 velocity dispersion is very nearly constant over the whole disk, except in the center, in this place north and this place south. And here the line width goes up by almost a factor of 2. And these things are not associated with star formation, supernovae, or anything else. This is an otherwise relatively quiescent galaxy. And Petrick and Rubin, did not give an explanation of what might be causing this. But this may be something similar to what we're seeing in the Milky Way in this small-scale distribution. So if we ask one of the things that we've learned, the Milky Way has an M equals 1 asymmetry in the plane of the disk, has three prominent modes. There are a few localized disturbances in the gas disk. The H1 scale heights are grossly different on either side of the sun center line, and the spiral arms are thinner than in the Andromeda gas. There are some things we'd like to know, that we'd still like to know. What maintains the nearly constant velocity dispersion? I should say these are not the only things we'd like to know, but some of the things that come out of this analysis. What keeps the gas flat? In other words, why does the gas layer remain flat, as it appears to do in other galaxies as well, beyond the edge of the stellar disk? What keeps it, what provides the gravity? How do spiral arms propagate beyond the edge of the stellar disk? Are the local H1 disturbances due to dark matter substructure, and are we seeing gas inflow or an asymmetric halo? And I leave it to the audience to get some of the answers to these questions in the coming years. Thanks.
What happens if you, you know, crash a mini-halo into a disk? I mean, this must have been simulated.
Not into a gas disk. This is some work that Sukanya Chakrabarty and I are planning to do. She's got a wonderful code. I had hoped to have some time to show a couple of slides from some work that she's done. But this is exactly what we'd like to do. Start out by putting in a big halo, 10 to the 9 solar mass sub-halo, 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 7th, see what kind of effects that you get. There may be work that has been done on this, but none that's published that I know of.
Leo, you raised this interesting idea of M equals 1 displacement of either the disk or the halo. And when we theorists make mass models of the galaxy, we naively assume that there's a disk and a dark matter halo centered around the disk. But in principle, the density of dark matter is fairly low in the disk compared with the density of the disk. The disk can be floating around the center of the dark matter halo. Do you know of any way to actually measure that, either the spatial displacement or the velocity of the disk with respect to the center of mass?
I'm not sure that we'll be able to get a unique answer, but I think that by combining these asymmetries that we see in the observed quantities, we may be able to put constraints on that, on these things as well. That's something, again, I think in the coming months I'd like to do. I'm hoping Martin, you know, Martin and I have talked a little bit about doing some of this work, and I hope we'll have an answer the next time we have a meeting on the Milky Way.
Leo, the
Hans.
Outer spiral arms you think you have identified, how do they line up with the molecular gas distribution in the inner part of the galaxy?
I have a plot of that, there's not such good agreement, but what we've tried to do is to redo the analyses of the 21 centimeter gas in the inner part of the galaxy. And it turns out that I don't think you can really do it. The spiral arms that have been done have been traced from H1 peaks. It's unclear what you're really tracing in this way. And the biggest problem is because you have gas coming at two different distances that we tried to separate, and we just couldn't get anything that gave consistent results. So I'm not sure how well defined most of the arms that have been traced, at least in the 21 centimeter gas, or even in the CO, really exist. I think this comes back to a point that Scott made in his first talk about where's the discussion about spiral structure. Well, most of the discussion about spiral structure has been in the inner part of the Milky Way, and I think if anything, the work that we've tried to do that I haven't shown here in doing it tells us that we're not going to make much progress in this unless we can find some way of getting it from the stars.
So, Leo, a couple of things. What I would call an obvious comment, the dynamical impulse from mini halos passing through the H1 disk is pretty pathetic. I mean, it's tiny, like a kilometer per second or something. So, I mean, how cold is this? The dynamical response to a mini halo.
Well,
as it moves through the gravity field of the mini halo, it's pretty pathetic.
Well, the response in.
So the H1 gas moving as a mini halo moves through the dark, the H1 disk.
Well,
the H1 response to that halo is not very.
But how do you know? We're taking 10 to the 7 solar masses. I mean, we looked
just
at the energy
to gravity.
We did a back of the envelope calculation about what's the energy, and you find that you have about two orders of magnitude more energy than you might have if you double the velocity dispersion from 8 to 16 kilometers per second over a few kiloparsecs. So if you have coupling,
that. As an impulse, I can't see that being possible, physically possible.
Okay,
I'm
well,
first comment.
Let's do the calculation on the board over coffee.
And the second comment. Second comment was the spiral arms.
Yeah.
I'm sure James James and Scott might know the answer to this, but the...
James is still asleep. He's jet-lagged here.
Jet-lagged. But the... Sorry, you didn't agree? Oh, thank you. Off to a good start. Right, I might flounder on the next one, but the Toomer AQ criterion for star formation in the outer disk and any kind of collapse and interesting behavior is very closely linked to the condition for spiral arm behavior. So seeing spiral arms, which are not due to some kind of perturber in outer disks, is very interesting in its own right. It has a Q value.
You would expect that it has.
Yeah. But have people found, it's a very naive question, have people found H1 spiral arms, what you would call non-quadrupole perturbing kind of interloper, which can perturb these over enormous distances? But have people found spiral arms a long way out in normal isolated spirals before? Because I don't think that's, in a classical sense, possible, unless Scott and James are going to crush me now.
There are a lot. I mean,
I'm hoping Scott or James will just jump in here and save my bacon, but they're not doing this. But isn't that true about spiral arm?
Well, I think the general opinion is that all theoretical physics of spiral arms is wrong.
This is not helping.
Okay. Back to the warp. I have a poster where I show that the stellar warp is also asymmetrical. It's not a simple S warp. And we try to fit the living warp, you showed, the H1 warp, to the stellar disk. And it seems that this is something close to that, but in fact, as your mode 0 and 2 start at 15 kiloparsec,
right.
And it is about too far for the stellar disk, because it should stop at about this distance. So it could maybe work if it starts closer for the stellar disk. So it seems that there is something quite similar in the stellar disk than in H1, but not exactly the same. And the slope of the warp is also lower in the stars. So maybe I think this is an information could be useful for people modeling the dynamics of this warp and to constrain the origin of the warp.
Yeah, I think one thing we have to be a little bit careful about the stuff that I've shown, is that it does depend on the rotation curve. Now, we've taken what's essentially a flat rotation curve. I think from the stars, you can get distances directly, depending on what you're using as tracers. So the fact that things agree in a general way, but may disagree in detail, I think one first has to look at the uncertainties, at least that we have, and look at it in the stars as well, to see whether any of these disagreements are in fact real or not.
So back to the issue of spiral arms and the outer disk beyond the nominal edge of the stellar disk, I just wanted to comment that Annette Ferguson in her thesis also found faint H2 regions well beyond the nominal edge of the stellar disk. Often you can join the dots and find an extension of inner spiral arms. And I would say two or three times, I think, in her galaxies, there was also evidence of a faint H1 arm as well in the outer disk. So I think this is something that's really pointing to just this issue that we don't understand how to apply Q and what is it. And we really need to think about star formation in regions that are, I would say, supposed to be stable, but they're obviously not.
Yes, and I just want to add, following Annette's work, it's been true that the galax observations are also showing evidence for star formation very far out in the disk, and where it's been possible to have enough H1 sensitivity. I mean, the biggest problem is that you're talking about really faint gas. This has to be done interferometrically, and interferometrically you're at the mercy of the H1 surface brightness if one is trying to get good maps. But where it's been possible to do so, this has been shown to be more than a peculiar result, but looks like it might be quite general.
So I just wanted to address this question about the spiral arms. You do see in these extended UV, the disks that have been seen in galaxy images by Filker, you do see new stars going well out beyond 20 kiloparsec. And these are in very thin spidery arms. So they could very well set up a density wave in the gas, in the same way that you know the gas responds to all stars inside of co-rotation.
Does it have anything to do with Q?
I haven't actually.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll find out what the answer to.
All right. I think we have to move ahead. Our next speaker.
Okay, thanks.
Next speaker is Martin Weinberg.